From KBIA News in Columbia, this is Intersection, conversations with our community. I'm Sarah Shariari. Today on Intersection, we visit the Art and Archaeology Museum at Mizzou North. We also visit Stevens College's latest fashion exhibit and talk with people in our community about how they interact with and even create art. We went to the University of Missouri's Museum of Art and Archaeology to talk with Museum Director Dr. Alex Barker. He gave us a tour and talked about a few of the works on display. Entering the main galleries and turning to the left, there is a piece that absolutely captures attention, even standing as it does among other impressive works. It's the figure of a man that's around 3 feet tall. It was made in the Democratic Republic of the Congo of wood, with nails and other pieces of metal sticking out of it.
As you walk in, the first thing you really see is a large figure in the back right. It's an Nkisi, or African nail fetish. It's called lots of different things. But what's cool about it, besides the fact that every kid who walks in remembers it, because it's a big human figure with nails and spikes and everything else driven into it, and they always think it's like one of those voodoo dolls that you stick pins in, and it's almost exactly the opposite. The whole idea of it is that it marks covenants, it helps you punish wrongdoers, and every time there's an agreement, if you and I want to make an agreement, we solemnize it by driving a nail into that figure. And for the figure to work, he has to have certain attributes. So there's a sort of receptacle in his belly that you can see. It's empty now, but normally it would have some white substance in it. There'd be mirrors or white substances in his eyes, and that allows the figure to do his job. Absent that, it's just a work of art, which is what it is now. But it's a very dramatic and imposing work of art, which is why we not only put it in its own case, but we lit the case internally so that you can really see the detail and you can have shadows going across the spikes and the nails so it pops when you look at it.
Moving on, there are several spaces filled with hundreds of small objects like amulets, jewelry, coins, sculptures, and pottery. Just the variety of the work is astounding. Alex points out a small stone Assyrian figure. It's a horned lion called Pazuzu.
Anytime you go through a museum with someone, you can get a very different experience based on what they talk about. I tend to talk about things in a very didactic sense. So there are moral lessons that go along with them, or things you can learn from them. Pazuzu is all about the absence of good or evil. Pazuzu is a really bad guy at some times. He's the demon of the wind. He brings plague. He brings drought. But he also is the opponent of another demon who terrorizes women during childbirth. So by invoking Pazuzu, you protect yourself at moments of great stress and danger. So is he good or bad? Well, it kind of depends on context. And if you're a farmer trying to get your crop out of the field, he can be a very dangerous and bad guy. If you're a woman giving birth, he's the friend you need. And like a lot of other things, good or bad sort of depends on context.
The Art and Archaeology Museum at Mizzou North also has European and American galleries with sculptures and paintings. The museum is carefully climate controlled, but there's a statue of St. Jerome with some interesting abilities.
As you enter the gallery, ahead and to the left, you'll see a gilt sculpture of St. Jerome. And in many ways, he's a barometer, literally. Because since he's carved wood, as the seasons change, if humidity varies at all, there's a crack in his back that widens and closes and widens and closes, and it's been doing it every year for hundreds of years.
There's also a room that contains a life-size, glimmering marble statue of two nymphs. In the same room, there are two pepper shakers made by Paul Revere. Yes, one if by land and two if by sea, Revolutionary War legend and silversmith Paul Revere. Close to those shakers is a portrait of a beautiful young woman.
There's a small green gallery that opens off the main European and American gallery, and it has works primarily from the 18th and 19th century. And as you stand in the entryway, your eye is drawn to a marble sculpture of two bathing nymphs. Besides being a beautiful sculpture, the marble is wonderful because it's got a deep luster, but it also has internal sparkle. And so it's almost as though there are drops of water on the bathing figures. looking past it, you see a case that has silver and gold work, including a couple of silver casters by Paul Revere.
Yeah, that marble is beautiful. It does. It shines. It almost seems luminous.
And especially from these angles, you can see the sparkle mm-hmm. off their back. So if you're standing in front of the case with the Paul Revere casters and you look to your left, there's a portrait of a woman. It's by Romney, who's one of the great portrait artists of the late 18th century in England. And it's a portrait of Lady Hamilton, who is a tragic and heroic figure in her own right. She was the lover of Lord Nelson. She was what there was of it in late 18th century England. But she also ends up dying penniless after the death of Nelson. But Romney thought so much of her that he painted her more than 100 times.
Wow, she's beautiful.
We actually have more than one portrait of her. We have another portrait by another artist who apparently thought less of her, and she's not nearly as attractive in that painting.
Beauty is in the eye, right?
Exactly.
Moving into the modern gallery, there are several paintings that tell stories about the not-so-distant and violent past.
Next to it is an illustration by N.C. Wyeth of the Battle of Westport. It's an incredibly dramatic painting. It's one of the studies done for the Capitol lunette. A lunette at the state capitol, and next to it is Ceres, who stands atop the state capitol. This is one of the original studies from which it was done.
Oh, that's amazing. So this Civil War scene is much larger on the state capitol?
Mm-hmm. It's depicted inside in one of the lunettes inside the state capitol. As you look up, there are lunettes in many different areas, and we have most of the studies for those lunettes. We have about 60 or so pieces in all. And behind you, as you walk in, are a series of much more dramatic pieces, even more dramatic than the Battle of Westport. They include a scene of labor unrest from the River Rouge riots in 1937, which was a major moment in the development of organized labor. The UAW was organizing at the Ford plant, and Ford security forces came in and began beating up the protesters. And they confiscated all of the cameras of the reporters who were covering the event and then denied that it took place. But one enterprising reporter actually switched the plates in his camera, and he gave them the unexposed plates and smuggled out the exposed plates. And after Ford had denied the event had happened, photos of it appeared in the newspaper. And it really was a changing moment for the UAW and its organization. Next to it is one of the most troubling paintings in the collection. It's the aftermath of a lynching. It's called American Tragedy, and it's from the 1930s. In the interpretive label, we explained that this is an important thing for people in Columbia to keep in mind because the last lynching in Columbia took place in the 1920s.
American Tragedy is a truly sorrowful painting. It shows a group of people lowering a black man's body from a tree. And the composition references other paintings of Christ being lowered from the cross. A few feet away from American Tragedy is a beautiful ceramic bust of a woman.
A few years ago, we acquired a bust of Modell by Beulah Ecton Woodard, who is an African-American artist. She was a very influential ceramicist on the West Coast, and this, to me, is one of her masterworks. Just at the time she was beginning to break out as an artist in the early 1950s, she was planning to go on a major European tour in 1955. It was really going to make her an internationally known artist, and she died on the eve of the tour. So she's not as well known as she should be, but the quality of the work certainly merits her inclusion as one of the great artists of the middle part of the 20th century.
The museum keeps a few pieces from Cuban artists on display, and the museum's next show will feature Cuban artists.
The next traveling show, we currently have an exhibition of Japanese prints, many from the 18th and 19th century. The next show planned after that is a show of Cuban art by two of the major living Cuban artists, Choco and Mendive. But we do have a few Cuban works that we keep on regular display. We have a very deep collection from the Ediciones Vigia Art Collective in Matanzas, Cuba, but we also have a few works by Cuban-American artists, including SOS Tanker, which is a large work on the back wall of the modern gallery. And it's a work that really challenges what's meant by the modern industrial world, by the isolation of Cuba. It's a large tanker that's shown with fractures going through it and a grid that's almost like a jail cell. And if you look carefully, there are a couple of figures in small boats just peering over the edges of their life rafts with sharks circling in the water. And it's an oil tanker instead of just a general ship. Lots of different references, and it can be constructed in many different ways. But the most striking thing about it is that the hull of the ship is this rusting hulk, and it's painted as a rusting hulk.
We looped back to the entrance hall, where that small group of exquisite Japanese prints is on display.
They're so beautiful. The color is so rich.
Well, the color is rich, but you'll notice that some of the rich colors are very vibrant blues. And blues are a fun thing in Japanese prints because originally in the early 19th century, those blues come from a couple of plants. One plant is sometimes called Japanese or Chinese indigo. The other plant is something called a dayflower. And at my house, I've been trying to grow a garden for several years in deep shade on a hill, and nothing works. But I keep planting things, and they never come up. What comes up instead are dayflowers, and they're all over Colombia. You'll find them in roadsides next to mailboxes. And they're this spindly little plant with bright cobalt blue flowers, two petals, and then it looks like there's a petal missing at the bottom, and it's actually a much smaller white petal that's hard to see. And that's used to make these blues up until about the middle of the 19th century. And at that point, they've known all along that these are fugitive colors. So if they're exposed to light too long, the same problem with lights in museums, that if they're exposed to light too long, the blues fade. So in the middle 1800s, they switch. As they become more and more exposed to European art, they start adopting chemically based pigments, including Prussian blue. And so you can date some of the prints by when they switch from one form of pigment to another.
So this is the one that we're looking at here is from 1862. So that would probably be chemically based blue?
Just about the time they switched over. And even here, while this is a relatively dim gallery with down lights on the individual pieces, even here the lights aren't shining directly on the works of art. They're shining on the floor in front of them so that there's a certain amount of reflected light in the prints and they don't get cooked by too much light in too short a time.
And how were these made? Were they made by carving into wood and then coloring it?
I'm glad you asked that, because we actually have an example of one of the blocks at the end of the gallery.
Wonderful.
And every one of the blocks is for a different set of the colors. And so multiple pulls had to be made to make a single print with all the different colors involved. And there were multiple artisans involved. There was an artist who came up with the original design. Then there are a series of carvers who are making the blocks. And then there are printmakers who are actually pulling the individual sheets.
So how did the museum come to hold this tremendous variety of pieces?
Did the museum already own all these prints and they were stored, or did you bring them in from somewhere else?
Every single print that's on display here was part of a gift. Not a single gift, but a whole series of gifts over the years. So just like much of our collection, we're really the beneficiary of local people who have donated important art collections to the museum. And in this case, an entire exhibition has been built from a series of separate donations from separate people over the years.
Wow. And so somewhere in the world, there's a huge amount of art that is not on display now, but that can be cycled into the museum in different exhibits?
Definitely. We have about 16,000 objects in our permanent collection, and between 3% and 6% are on display at any one time. Now, sometimes people respond by saying, well, why don't you send it somewhere else where it could be shown? But these are a good example of why we have so many objects versus a much smaller number on display. These can't be shown all the time. This is a special exhibition. After this exhibition comes down, they go into folders in the dark. So they'll be around for your children and my children and their children to see as well.
That's the end of our brief tour of the Museum of Art and Archaeology at Mizzou North. It's amazing to me how each piece has a tremendous story behind it. I appreciate hearing them and imagining the people who used, created, and are portrayed in all these works. Now we're moving on to another exhibit. It's Real to Real, Hollywood's Influence on American Fashion at Stevens College. This exhibit is up through December 13th, and KBIA's Gamel Sabingo toured the exhibit and brought us this report.
When walking into the room for a tour of Stevens College Costume and Museum Research Library's Real to Real exhibit, You notice immediately a painting of a stylish and classic Audrey Hepburn wearing a large 60s styles hat and donning a little black dress. She's pulling her glasses down while innocently looking to the right. Then you discover the painting is a backdrop to three black dresses draped over white mannequins that are part of the Breakfast at Tiffany's section of the exhibit. The film was released in 1961, a time where Jackie Kennedy was coming of age and just before baby boomers reached puberty. Dean of School of Fashion and Design and curator of the Costume Museum and Research Center, Monica McMurray, says the film was influential to fashion at the time, particularly with the little black dress.
And, you know, you can't go wrong with the little black dress. So the little black dress had been around since the 20s with Chanel, but the little black dress came really into its own through Breakfast at Tiffany's.
McMurray, along with a guest curator Cheryl Farnan and assistant curator Jennifer Cole, sought to explore the relationship between Hollywood films and everyday fashion in the 20th century from the 1930s to the 1990s. 13 films are represented from Gone to the Wind to Pretty Woman. The exhibit begins with the 1930s, with movies from the Depression era like Dinner at Eight and Letty Litton. McMurray says that films were a form of escape for many people at the time and a way to get a glimpse into wealthier society.
You got to remember, everybody was rather agrarian, so that you didn't live in the cities. You didn't, and most people weren't at those cocktail parties and such. So it was a way to kind of dream about what another lifestyle could be like.
Cole, the assistant curator, says the style during this time period was classical and not exactly affordable to the average person.
It was a look that was hot, and everyone wanted it, and they could achieve it. I mean, if they had the money to do it, you know, again, this is 1932, so not a lot of people were able to do that, but those people that were, you know, were very stylish.
The rise of World War II and the war in the Pacific in the 1940s brought with it a new style imbued with tropical prints and sarong-style dress, portrayed in Dorothy L'Amour as the Jungle Princess. But it also brought with it several restrictions, as is evidenced by Gone with the Wind. Cole explains that because fabric was being redirected for war resources, individuals relied on accessories like hats.
Before war, but into the 40s, this is how people were able to spruce up their wardrobe, because they couldn't just, you know, they didn't have endless supplies of clothing, so they could buy a new hat and, you know, have kind of a new look.
Films like Elizabeth Taylor's A Place in the Sun in the 1950s made the iconic silhouettes typical of prom dresses or ball gowns of today extremely popular. McMurray says the silhouette has been redone for generations.
This very feminine, hourglass, full-hipped look. Some of that just never goes out of style in more formal wear or times of tradition like with weddings.
Dr. Zhuago and Space Odyssey 2001 heavily influenced fashion in the 60s. Flower children began to look at vintage clothes and how to incorporate clothes from other cultures into their style. John Travolta's Saturday Night Fever was reflective of women's new liberated style. McMurray said Calvin Klein jeans and shiny fabric accentuated women's curves and bodies.
Shiny was really important because of disco lights and, you know, fit. There was a lot of very deep plunging necklines and just kind of a general sexiness to the clothes.
Cole says she was in high school when Desperately Seeking Susan, the 1985 film starring a young Madonna, came out. It was the age of MTV and new media and technology created a pressure to become a Madonna wannabe. Madonna brought with her the idea of the unique do-it-yourself style, employing the use of jewelry, leather jackets, and netted gloves. McMurray says the film was also reflective of how young women were beginning to have a new voice.
I think it was young women just really expressing their voice that was the controversial part. Mm-hmm. That she was ready to put on hard leather like a male, you know, Hell's Angel or something. And so that's a new way of dressing, of thinking, of kind of being in your face.
Meryl Streep's Out of Africa, released in the same year, was reflective of the changing climate as women began working outside of the home. The style was similar to men's, bringing with it a heavy use of the khaki, from trench coats to pants. Designers and brands like Ralph Lauren and Banana Republic were quick to pick this style up. The Julia Roberts and Richard Gere's 1990 film Pretty Woman concludes the exhibit, reflecting the rise of the celebrity as a fashion star. McMurray stresses that fashion indeed is reflective of culture, and movies have had a large influence in its creation.
There's a lot more to what people are wearing than what they're wearing. That it always reflects what's happening in culture, what's happened previously in culture. So what someone chooses to wear speaks, it has its own language, but then it has an individual speech and then it has a collective speech.
Definitely something to remember the next time you pull out that little black dress. Kimel Sabingo, KBIA, Columbia.
Thanks, Kimel, for that story on Reel to Reel, Hollywood's influence on American fashion at Stevens College. So where do you go in Columbia to experience or even create art? Helen Tien of our community outreach team spoke with a few Columbia residents.
My name's Hannah McClellan. I live in Columbia. I went to Mizzou and graduated in 2014. In my spare time, I mean, I don't have a lot of time to do art myself, but I like to go to the First Fridays every month. It's pretty much a habit at this point. I go every First Friday and go to all the galleries downtown. For someone who's never been to First Friday, it's just basically a time just to get together with people in Columbia in the like North Village Art District and just kind of travel around between several of the different galleries. Some of them put on like specific events, like they'll have bands and things like that. But there's usually just good food and just like wine and beer. And it's just a kind of a time to go look at all the new exhibits. There's local artists as well as artists from outside of the area. And just kind of see all the different works they're doing. Living across from like the community garden is nice because you see a lot of people that, I mean, that's how I found out about the mural painting. I was sitting outside with some friends. They were just like playing their guitar. And we had one of the neighborhood community people came up, gave us a flyer that there was gonna be an event to finish painting a mural that had been started but never finished on a building that was like going to be demolished, and then I guess they just saved it. So they were just trying to get like people in the community out to help finish it. And I guess just also it helps you feel kind of invested in the community when you're being a part of it by putting your literal mark on something.
So my name is Lauren Swartz. I own Lo and Behold in the North Village Arts District, downtown Columbia. So whether it be like through fashion, which I own a boutique, so really right now that's my outlet, is finding like clothes that are beautiful and unique and being able to bring those into Columbia and create whatever it is that you feel on the inside, on the outside. But I mean, I have a lot of hobbies as far as like just drawing and do a lot of crafting, and I also flip houses, so being able to go into a house that's super raw and create a new space, that's a huge passion of mine.
A few months ago, I recorded an episode of Hearsay, another KBIA show, at the Art and Archaeology Museum. The theme was beauty, and to finish up this show, I want to play you pieces of some of those interviews. Sometimes technology is blamed for distracting us from the world around us. But Sue Roten from Bolivar, Missouri, says that it helps her be a keen observer.
I am an avid Instagrammer, which is a weird thing to bring up, except one of the reasons I tell my kids that, you know, here in my 50s here, I've come to appreciate this young people's medium, is I feel like I don't travel widely, but a lot in the state of Missouri, and I feel like even in the most commonplace things, it helps you to keep an eye out for what's unique or beautiful.
Kristen Schwain is an associate professor of American art. She says that lately she's been finding a great deal of beauty in the world beyond the museum.
I will say right now, it's my daughter who's going to be 3, and it's her smile, and it's when she tells me in the morning whether she wants, when you know, ponytails or braids. But it's also children's books. Children's books have the most amazing illustrations, and some of them are ingenious. So it's kind of seeing the world through her eyes, and it's also reading through her eyes.
Schwain also points out one work of art. It's a figure called the antennalope, created by a Korean artist.
He uses historical technology, and so he creates with these old TVs and old cabinets, you know, the stuff that you remember from your grandmother's house or that you maybe now see in antique malls. And he built an antelope out of that. And it raises all sorts of questions about how are we, what is the relationship between nature and culture, nature and technology? How much of our concept of nature has been filtered through technology, and what do we really know about nature? But it's also just neat looking, and it's fun.
Reed is 8 years old, and he was visiting the museum. He agrees with Kristen that the antennalope is pretty amazing.
It was the weirdest thing I've ever seen. I find it beautiful and ugly.
To see some of the artwork we talk about, you can visit our programs page at kbia.org. And if you'd like to share your favorite Mid-Missouri art spaces with us, you can visit our Intersection Facebook page. Or tweet us at IntersectKBIA. I want to thank our producers, Katie Eisterhold and Eileen Lee, our community outreach team of Helen Tien and Kara Tabor, and reporter Gamel Sabingo, who contributed to this show. And of course, thank you to our guests, Alex Barker, Monica McMurray, and Jennifer Cole. Our music this week is Poddington Bear and Montana Skies. I'm Sarah Shariari for Intersection, right here on KBIA 91.3 FM.